It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power with Mark Gillar.
Good morning and welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar. My special guest today is Jim DeFelice. He is the author of Omar Bradley, General at War. Jim DeFelice is an award-winning writer, a former political columnist, and a prolific best-selling author of more than three dozen military books and spy thrillers. His previous works explore the effects of war, politics, terrorism, and technology on both soldiers and civilians. Jim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Mark. It's really nice to be here this morning.
Well, I know my Tea Party listeners are going to enjoy hearing about this new book. Now, when you think of Omar Bradley, you think of a guy that was kind of always in the shadows of other generals, you know, guys like Patton, who didn't have much trouble hogging a lot of credit. Is that because he wanted it that way?
You know, it's surprising. Omar Bradley is probably one of the, if not the most important general in terms of the European theater for the American army, at least certainly one of the top two. And yet he really hasn't gotten that much attention outside of specialists and those of us, you know, who really paid attention to history in school. And largely, I think, or a lot of that has to do with his personality. He was a guy who wanted to achieve results and really didn't care about making fancy speeches, let alone standing up in front of cameras and, you know, getting his picture in the newspaper.
Well, he was quite popular with the troops, though. In fact, he was nicknamed the GI General. How did he get that nickname?
Well, he part of it, I think, and again, it goes back to really to his character. I think that he grew up in Missouri in a small town, had a lot of what we would call, what we would unfortunately call old-fashioned values these days.
Yeah.
I think actually they're very still alive, at least among those of us, you know, who believe in that sort of thing. He was very much for very respectful of his neighbors, very a self-reliant guy. He rose really from humble beginnings. Was born in a log cabin. His father unfortunately died when he was 13, and he worked his way through high school. Was lucky enough to get into West Point, and really even during the summers, after he became an officer, instead of taking leave, he actually took some part-time jobs. Well, they were full-time, but they would last only a few months. So he's really kind of, you know, really kind of the embodiment of the, you know, old-fashioned, you know, values, you know, work hard, you know, get ahead by the sweat of your brow. And I think because of that, he had an appreciation for what at the time would have been called the common Joe, the regular guy. And he really could relate to those people, I think, because in a lot of ways, even though he had succeeded and become a general and a great leader, he still identified with them.
Now, the name Omar in itself is a bit unusual. Tell the listeners why his parents chose that name.
Well, you know, if I could figure that out 100%, I think that I would have been really satisfied. It's one of the great. There are several mysteries about Bradley. That happens to be one of them. It's believed that he was probably named after what today would be called populist type writers and semi-politician types out in the Midwest, but we're not 100% sure that, you know, his father was a school teacher and a part-time farmer, and he really admired the people who spoke for those issues at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries, and it looks like he was named after, like Omar was named after an editorial writer and publisher. But to be honest, there's no smoking gun on that. There's nowhere does it say, you know, my son is named after such and such. And Bradley himself was never 100% sure, I don't believe. So it's one of those great at least at the moment, one of those great mysteries of history.
Well, what's interesting is that my last name is Galar, and when my wife and I were expecting, I kept throwing out the idea, if it were a boy, naming it Omar Galar. I thought it sounded like a great name. You could go into the military or go into show business with a name like that. And my wife eventually convinced me to go with something a little more traditional, like Christopher, which is my son's name. But we actually tossed that name around for a while. Now, one of the things that I think is important to making General Bradley who he is was the relationship with his father. I mean, his father did die at an early age, but prior to that, he wasn't just Omar Bradley's father. He was really his best friend, his hunting companion. There was a pretty close relationship there, was there not?
Oh, absolutely, Mark. I mean, it was, if you were looking for the single most important influence on Omar Bradley's life, it was his dad. As I said, they came from very humble beginnings, literally a one-room house when they were first starting out. And as they grew up, when Omar was old enough to go to school, he would actually go to school with his dad because his father was a school teacher, and this is back in the days of the one-room schoolhouses. And at the time in Missouri, where they were in the rural countryside there, the school teacher would actually commute to different schools. And Bradley's dad, because he was one of the few male teachers, he got some of the schools where the kids were most rambunctious, but also the schools that were kind of a little bit further away because he could walk further. So he and his son would set out early in the morning, a couple hours, and walk literally four or five miles a day in all kinds of weather to get to the school. And they just spent so much time together that it was incredible. His dad taught him, as you said, taught him how to hunt at a very young age. That was a story that Omar Bradley loved to tell about how he had learned to hunt and the lessons that he got. His father taught him not only numbers and reading, but he also taught him how to play baseball. And baseball ended up as a very important influence on Bradley, the idea of working with a team and how an individual could excel, and yet the more important thing was for the entire team to do well.
Well, one of the things that you mention is that an accident early on, a skating accident, left him with some rather damaged teeth in the front, and that this may have contributed to his shyness. And then at one point, I think he had all his teeth pulled, which made the incident made the issue even worse. He was, in fact, a very shy man throughout most of his life, was he not?
I think that, I guess I, like all writers, probably have a tendency to play amateur psychologist, so let me admit that I may be, that I am reading a little bit into the historical record here and kind of, trying to figure out where he was coming from. But he absolutely had injured his teeth. At the time, dental science was not quite as advanced as it is today, and they were relatively, as I said, poor. So his teeth were injured when he was very young from a skating accident, as you mentioned, and he never really could get them fixed properly. So much so that later on in life, as you say, he was advised to have them all pulled, and he was always in some amount of discomfort. I don't know exactly how much pain. I guess it varied from time to time. But he felt very, very self-conscious about it. And if you notice most of his photos, his mouth is kind of clamped closed. Now, I have to admit that anyone who's really, truly shy is probably not going to become a five-star general. I mean, to become a general and even to advance in ranks in the Army, one does have to put themselves out a bit. But he always did tend to be not necessarily awkward, but a little bit reserved in dealing with crowds. I guess like all young men, or at least from my own experience, it was a little bit awkward with women at first, although later on they seemed to be attracted to him because he was kind of a dashing older gentleman presence. But he's definitely not, he was much better in one-on-one or small group situations than in large, you know, large audiences. That's very clear from looking at his history.
Well, yeah, that was one of the things I was getting as I was reading some of the book, is that, you know, here's a guy who seemed content to allow other people to take credit. It's almost like he was living by Ronald Reagan's ideals. You know, of course, Reagan would come many years later, but, you know, Reagan's famous for saying you can accomplish a lot if you don't care who gets the credit. And that seemed to be a motto that General Bradley lived by. But at the same time, if you're completely content with other people getting the credit, you usually don't rise to five-star general. So there had to be some ambition in there somewhere.
No, you're absolutely right. I think, and one thing I think that is key there is that it was not only his personality, but also I think that that time, that whole generation, and certainly while Reagan is not quite as old, say, you know, he was kind of in that same, you know, that similar generation. I think it's tough for us today to totally identify with that. This is one of our probably one of our failings. We tend to equate effectiveness and, you know, someone being a great leader with them, you know, being very outgoing and outspoken about themselves. And I think there's a difference between being outspoken about yourself and your position. And Bradley, when he was doing his job, when he was advocating his position or talking about what U.S. Army soldiers could do, and we see this time and again in discussions with the British, he was always standing up for what the American Army could do. You know, he was very outspoken. But when it came to pushing his own, you know, self, his own person, he wasn't quite as loud. And I think that if it hadn't been for the war, where his talents as a tactician and as an organizer and as someone who could get along with other generals, those qualities were really in demand in the war. Had it not been for the war, he probably would have made general, but I doubt that he would have played an important role in the Army.
It seems like whenever you mention famous U.S. military generals, the name, you know, the first names people would think about would be, you know, Eisenhower or Patton. And in fact, at one point, General Bradley was one of Patton's biggest defenders. You mentioned in the book that he tried to cover up the slapping incident.
Yes, and I don't want to take anything away from Eisenhower and Patton, because they are clearly, you know, when we're talking about Eisenhower, Patton, and Bradley, we're talking about people who are, you know, operating at a very, very high level here. You know, it's like, again, to use a sports metaphor, you know, if we're talking about baseball all-stars, the tippity-top, you know, cream of the crop here. So, you know, we have to remember that. But Bradley and Patton had an incredibly complicated relationship during the war, as I guess we would imagine, because of what's going on and the drama that they're really involved with. And at one point, a somewhat famous incident now in Patton's life, on Sicily, he went to a hospital, a military hospital, and there encountered someone who was suffering from battle fatigue, or what was called battle fatigue at the time. And Patton's reaction to this was to slap the man and tell him to get back to imply that he should get back to the front, or at least get out of his sight. Now, even at the time, that was considered, and the way that he did it was considered just not the right thing to do. And a report was written up on what he did on the incident, and it was sent up the line, intended to go to Eisenhower. But because of the way that the chain of command worked, the report happened to go to Omar Bradley. And Bradley at the time had not been Bradley and Patton's relationship at this point was really at a low point. Patton had made some tactical moves that put Patton's, Patton had made some tactical moves that had put Bradley's troops in danger and made some other decisions that, in retrospect, probably weren't the best military decisions. And Bradley had pointed that out and gotten hell for it and still held his ground, but the two men had a lot of friction there. Even so, Bradley saw the report, realized that it would be devastating to Patton's career, and so what he did with it, he took it and he walked over to his safe and he locked it in his safe as if that would kind of, you know, and everyone would forget about it. But unfortunately for Patton, the information about the incident got to Eisenhower through other ways, and Patton eventually did get in some trouble.
Yeah, I think we all remember the movie Patton and how that incident played out. But, you know, that incident compared with another one involving Bradley really helps contrast the two men. I mean, here you have a case of Patton actually slapping a soldier, and you mentioned in the book a case where General Bradley actually took his coat off and gave it to a freezing GI.
Yeah, you know, and I have to say that when I started writing the book, I had... you know, everyone had been calling Bradley the GI General, and all these, you know, there was all these things about these good feelings, and I was skeptical. I call me cynical, but I didn't believe. I thought there might have been one incident or so, but I didn't really think that that was, you know, justified. And come to find out, as you actually look through, you start going through all of the material and some diary entries and other information, it turns out he actually did that several times, and there are plenty of instances of him either giving in that case he gave his coat to a shivering MP and told him, you take this, I see you're cold, I can, it's easier for me to get one. Other times he gave people rides. Generals usually can travel any way they want. Well, he would often just hitch, especially during Normandy in the early days in France, he would just hitch a ride on a truck or, you know, whatever he could find. He didn't so much pull rank. He just, you know, wanted to get there. So it was, as I said, it's, you know, it's kind of incredible to us today, I think. But, you know, his personality was a regular guy, and he wanted to get things done, and he managed to find a way to actually do it.
Now, you also mentioned that he was known for using his personal rifle to take shots at enemy planes.
He was a good shot. yeah, we were joking. I was joking with someone the other day who knew quite a bit about Patton, and we came to the conclusion that one of the differences between Patton and Bradley is Patton carried around some very fancy pearl-handled pistols, which he called his social guns.
I thought they were ivory.
I'm sorry, did I say pearl? Well,
so, don't you remember
those? You're right. No, you're right. I guess I'm kind of making them more and more fancy as I go along here.
He said he made some reference to Bourbon Street when someone called them pearl-handled once.
<That's right.
laughs> I'm sorry, go ahead. I apologize.
No, that's true. And then but Bradley, on the other hand, you know, had a rifle with him and would just shoot you before you got a chance to pull your pistol out of your holster. You know, he was that kind of practical guy. But Bradley did travel with a rifle. Now, as a general, obviously he actually has an aide who would be holding the rifle.
Sure.
And many times in Sicily, especially, but also in Africa, as he was out on the front lines figuring out what they were going to do, they would be attacked by German aircraft. And Bradley, rather than jumping into the trench, would call for his rifle and start shooting at the German aircraft. I think it's pretty clear that he was doing that to help inspire his men. But there's also a part of Bradley where I think he would rather take shots at somebody than hide from them. So it was pretty interesting. There was one time that his aide had forgotten to bring the rifle from the from the Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had to jump into the trench. And legend has it that the aide never forgot to bring the rifle again. It was one of the few times Bradley got mad.
Well, you mentioned in the book that Bradley deserves most of the credit for the victories in North Africa as opposed to Patton. Tell our listeners why you believe that.
Well, what happened is Bradley is sent over to Africa after the Americans have suffered a number of losses there. And quite honestly, we didn't perform very well. Bradley was sent there to figure out what was going on. And one of the things that he realizes almost right away is that Americans just at the time were kind of reluctant to close and kill their enemy, close with and kill their enemy. And you know, they started working on that. At the same time, Eisenhower decides to, it was clear that they needed a new commander. And Eisenhower takes Patton and puts Patton in charge. Patton talks with Bradley and asks Bradley to stay on as his deputy. And together they start, in layman's terms, kicking butt and rearranging the American forces there. Then the Americans go on and do fairly well, and the Germans are kicked out of Tunisia. And we have all these great stories about this fantastic tank strategy that beat those Nazis, and it was only because of this really forward thinking, this tank guy, and all this great stuff. Well, come to find out, and all the stories accrediting Patton. Well, come to find out, Patton had actually, although the newsmen didn't know this, Patton had gone back to plan for the invasion of Sicily weeks and weeks before the attack even started. It was actually Bradley who was the one who had come up with this quote-unquote great tank strategy and led the troops to victory. So, a lot of what was being put in the newspapers was wrong. Now, it certainly wasn't Patton's fault. I mean, he already had the reputation. And to some extent, it wasn't necessarily the reporters either, because they weren't being, for military purposes, they weren't being told everything that was going on. But on the other hand, they really didn't make much of an effort after the fact to kind of correct the record.
Well, one of the things that you point out in the book is that Omar Bradley was very innovative. He sort of came up with the idea of these fast-moving campaigns, and he also was the first to very creatively and successfully combined aircraft, artillery, and ground troops into one campaign.
Well, I think that kind of a common common gloss or opinion on Bradley is he's kind of this plodding infantryman, and that turns out that's absolutely not true when you actually look at what his plans for the campaigns were, how he used his troops, and how he combined different arms like the artillery, infantry, armor, and the aircraft. There's a lot of people who get credit, and certainly Patton was very forward-thinking, and together Bradley and Patton came up with a lot of good ideas. In the case of combining air power and advancing armor, for instance, Bradley was extremely open to the idea and was greatly influenced by another guy who probably, I'm sure most people don't know, Pete Cassata, who was Bradley's air commander, kind of a dashing, if you have an image of a dashing young, he's a little bit older than young, but dashing pilot during World War II, Cassata would be the guy. And he just realized that there were all sorts of possibilities. And something as simple as sticking a man with a radio in a tank or in a Jeep with the tank as the troops advanced turned out to be a revolution in terms of coordinating, allowing them to coordinate the armor and air. Now, the practicalities of that are actually somewhat more complex than I'm making it sound. But Bradley Bradley was very much open to different ideas. He didn't always accept them, and some of the ideas that they tried didn't necessarily work. But if you came to him, if you were an underling and you came to him with an idea, he always listened to what you said, and he could be an extremely enthusiastic supporter and even innovator if the idea happened to click.
Well, I think that's the mark of a great leader, whether it's in the military or corporate America or, you know, academics or wherever. I mean, someone willing to listen. And I think he would have been successful regardless of his career choice, just based on that one particular characteristic. We are almost out of time. Tell me, or better yet, tell the listeners how they can get a hold of a copy of this great book.
Well, you can get Omar Bradley, General at War, at any local bookstore. You could also get it online at Amazon.com. If you want to get a free chapter, you can get it at from my website, JimDeFelice.com. You can also go on Facebook if you want. Just type in Omar Bradley into the search, and Omar has his own little page on Regnery History, which is my publisher. And you know, hopefully you like that, you read that first chapter and you want the rest of the book.
Fantastic. We're gonna throw up a few links on our website, teapartypowerhour.com, and we'll link to some of those things you just mentioned to make it easier for the listeners to get a copy. Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here today. I've got to be honest, throughout my life, I haven't read a whole lot of military books, but you've converted me. I love this. This is a great book. It's a great human story wrapped within a military story, and I think there are great lessons to be learned by anyone who reads it even today. So thank you so much for coming on. Great book. I wish you much success with it.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure. And I just have to say that really that it's not really about me. It's really about Omar Bradley. And I think that he's a really good example for our times.
Absolutely, he is. And at a time when we can use more leaders, more great leaders to guide us, going back in time to Omar Bradley seems like a very, very good idea. So once again, thanks for being here today. Much success with the book. And, you know, we want to have you on again to talk about this.
Great.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.